My talk is entitled Sila Paramita, The Perfection of Ethics, the second of the Bodhisattva's transcendental virtues. So I wanted to actually start off by telling you the structure of my talk so it's easier to follow. So there's three parts to my talk. In the first part, I go through the precepts and explore a little bit their meaning. And secondly, I describe the essence and the uniqueness of Buddhist ethics. So it's actually, you know, what do we mean by Buddhist ethics? And thirdly, I demonstrate the uniqueness of Buddhist ethics in comparison to the ethics of other ethical systems. Just so that we know what we're talking about in terms of Buddhist ethics. And because I find it a bit clumsy to actually sort of give references throughout my talk, particularly when it's ideas, you know, it's different when you're giving a quote, but particularly when it's ideas, and because I'm very grateful to a number of people who have written about ethics, and I've drawn from the work of quite a lot of people, I just want to express my gratitude up front for the inspiration I've received for reading, listening to other people's works. So I just wanted to say, I mean, the first person I want to express my gratitude to is the Buddha. And I've drawn quite sort of extensively from the Pali Canon and the Buddha's life. I also wanted to thank Sangharakshita, our teacher, particularly for his excellent book on ethics. If you want to follow up the theme of ethics, Sangharakshita has written a very good book called The Ten Pillars of Buddhism. So I've drawn from that as well. And Jnanavacha, the chair of the London Buddhist Centre, who gave a fantastic talk in January called Of Gods and Men. It's on free Buddhist audio, actually, so it's worth listening to it if you weren't here. And I read two booklets, one by Padma Vajra, called Training in the Ten Precepts, and Ratnaghosha, for his booklet, The Power of the Precepts. And I googled ethics, Buddhist ethics, and up came this wonderful paper by somebody called V.A. Gunasekara. Don't know who it is, but it was a very good paper. So I thought I'd get that all up front, and then I don't have to keep on saying, you know, this idea or this quote is from so-and-so. So, I've given you the structure, but by way of introduction, I want to follow on from what Shubha said about my name. So I'm thrilled, actually, to be giving this talk, because ethics is has always been a very important part of my practice. My private preceptor, we don't choose our names, actually. We're given these names by a private preceptor. And as Shubha said, she translated it as She Who Beautifies the Forest. And when we're ordained into the Triratna Buddhist community, when we're ordained into the Triratna Buddhist community, we're given names that are either challenging aspirations for us or aspects of us that are already there but need further unfolding. The challenging aspiration for me was the forest part of my name. This was given to me when I was in a very pressurized and a very demanding job. Thank goodness I'm not there anymore, actually. But anyway, and this job kept me out there a lot of the time. So my preceptor very wisely said that, you know, she was giving me forest as part of the name. In fact, that vana is the forest bit, and that is Pali. Normally it's Sanskrit, but the Sanskrit for forest is Aranya. And because I'm from Venezuela and I speak Spanish and my family all speak Spanish, Aranya in Spanish is spider. So my tray very wisely thought, my family's not going to take me very seriously if I've got spider in my name, actually. But She said that it was, you know, the challenge was to go inwards and rest in the still forest of my heart in the midst of all that chaos. And that was a challenge indeed, actually. And as Shubha said, the other part of my name is related to ethics, because she said that ethical behaviour beautifies one's surroundings. So I've always been greatly attracted to beautiful behaviour. I remember avidly reading Jane Austen's novels as a teenager. Come put them down. And really responding to the kind, generous, elegant and polite behaviour of some of her characters. So, for example, Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice. I used to love all of this, actually. And with hindsight, what I realise, it was my first encounter with ethical behaviour. And I really responded to that even when I was a young teenager. But for Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth, this kind of ethical... My husband said to me, actually, this morning, when I was sort of running through the talk with him, he said, that's not ethics, that's manners, actually. But in actual fact, for me, it was beautiful behaviour, which reminded me of ethics. And, you know, true ethical behaviour, as you'll see through my talk, comes in, you know, from inward motivation and so on. For Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy, this may have been cultural and conditional, and maybe just demonstrated to certain classes in England at the time, which is not exactly Buddhist. So, the question I'd like to ask now is what do we mean when we refer to Buddhist ethics? So that's my next point. The core ethical code of Buddhism is known as the five precepts. These five precepts cover the principles of loving kindness, generosity, contentment, truthfulness, and mindfulness. Those are the five precepts. And they're usually presented both in their positive and in their negative formulation, in the positive and negative form. So in the negative form, we have non-violence, non-appropriation, avoiding sexual misconduct, avoiding false speech, and abstaining from drink and drugs that cloud the mind. So the negative formulations point to a standard of behaviour below which we would not want to fall. The positive formulations open up to a dimension beyond the self and point to our essential interconnectedness. It's really very beautiful. I mean, sometimes people think ethics is a bit dry, but actually, when you really get into ethics, it is beautiful. Yeah. In the Abhisandha Sutta, the Buddha says that undertaking the precepts is a gift to oneself and to others. So I quote from that sutta, and he says, in undertaking the precepts, she gives freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. In giving freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings, she gains a share in limitless freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, and freedom from oppression. This is the gift, the great gift, original, long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated from the beginning, that is not open to suspicion, will never be open to suspicion, and is unfaulted by knowledgeable recluses and monastics. This is the reward of merit, reward of skillfulness, nourishment of happiness, celestial, resulting in happiness, leading to nirvana, leading to what is desirable, pleasurable, and appealing, to welfare and to happiness. Wow. So with that endorsement of the five precepts, let's quickly move on to examining the five precepts. I'm not going to go into great detail or in great depth in each of the precepts, because in a couple of weeks' time we've got four members of the team that are actually giving talks on four of the precepts, not on generosity, because we've had 6 weeks on generosity already. But they're going to be reflecting on the precepts and saying how the precepts, you know, manifest in their lives. So I'm not going to steal their thunder, but I'm actually going to say just briefly what each of the five precepts are about. So the first of the five precepts, in its negative form, is I undertake the training principle of abstaining from taking life. So this is about not killing or causing harm to other living beings. It conveys the meaning of abstention from all forms of violence, all forms of oppression, all forms of injury, because ultimately they are expressions of hatred or aversion. The positive counterpart of this precept is, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. Love is the only force strong enough to overcome hatred, and for this reason, it is the most powerful weapon in the world. As it says in the Dhammapada, a text that contains the teachings of the Buddha, hate is not conquered by hate. Hate is conquered by love. This is the eternal law. So the first precept is the fundamental ethical principle for Buddhism, and all other precepts are elaborations of this one. The implication of this is that if we sincerely try to practice non-violence and fill our hearts with love, we will find in the long run that we are practicing every other precept. In principle, they're all contained in non-violence and loving kindness. So it's a very crucial, fundamental precept, that first precept. The second precept is I undertake the training principle of abstaining from taking the not given. And in its positive form, with open-handed generosity, I purify my body. I will be very brief here, as we've just had a session on the perfection of generosity, but I will say something in case some of you have not attended the first session on generosity. So, not taking the not given, what immediately comes to mind is stealing. Which is an obvious way in which we can harm others. But it's not just about stealing. We can also take advantage of people, exploit or manipulate them, take their time when they're busy and they're not willing to give it. All these can be seen as ways of taking the not given. The positive counterpart of this precept is generosity. Essentially a positive, outward-going attitude, an urge to give and to share. And as we discussed at some length in the first session, enlightened beings practice different kinds of giving. So there's giving of material things. There's giving of education and culture. The giving of fearlessness. The giving of the gift of the Dharma. and even the giving of life and limb when required. That's a bit difficult to take on board, but there you are. So that's the second precept. The third precept is, in its negative form, is I undertake the training principle of abstaining from sexual misconduct. In the sutras, and you probably know that the sutras are the texts that contain the Buddha's teachings. So in the sutras, the Buddha makes it clear that sexual misconduct comprises rape, abduction, and adultery. And all three are unskillful because they are expressions of both craving and of violence. Sex, as everybody knows, is a very powerful urge. The Buddha once said that if there was another samsaric force that was as strong, we'd have no chance or no hope of spiritual development. So thank goodness. So taking our practice of Buddhism seriously would mean that we would actively try to give less importance to our sexual activity and instead let it become a natural part rather than a major focus of our lives. We can sometimes make sex the central part of our lives for psychological reasons, as a means of using sex to satisfy neurotic needs in general, and in particular, using it to satisfy the neurotic need for change. The positive counterpart of this precept is, with stillness, simplicity, and contentment, I purify my body. I love that positive formulation of that precept. Stillness, simplicity, and contentment. Possibly because I didn't have much of that in my life. I am getting quite a lot of that now. So what we can all aim to do is cultivate stillness, simplicity, and contentment in this area of life, aiming to be contented with our situation, whether we're married or single, homosexual or heterosexual, whether we choose to be sexually active or not. What's important is that we should bring a spirit of non-harming to our sexual activities. But contentment is much more than this. It's about generally accepting our situation. The following story from the Pali Canon illustrates the Buddha's teaching on contentment. And he says, "Monks, Kāsapa here is content with any old robe. He praises contentment with any robe, nor does he commit any offence of unseemliness or impropriety on account of a robe. If he has not got a robe, he doesn't worry. If he has got a robe, he enjoys the use of it without clinging or foolish attachment, not committing any offence, aware of the danger, and wisely avoiding it. Kāsapa is content with whatever alms he gets, whatever lodging, whatever requisites in the way of medicines for sickness. He enjoys the use of these things without clinging or foolish attachment, not committing any offence, aware of the danger, and wisely avoiding it. Therefore, monks, you should train yourselves thus. We will be content with whatever robe, alms, lodgings, medicines we may get. We will enjoy the use of these things without clinging or foolish attachment, not committing any offence, aware of the danger and wisely avoiding it. Monks, I will exhort you by the example of Kāsapa, or one like Kāsapa. So exhorted, you should practice to gain the goal." So, any old robe. The third precept. The fourth precept is, both in its positive and negative form, is I undertake the training principle of abstaining from false speech. And the positive, with truthful communication, I purify my speech. Speech is the crucial element of our relationship with others, and yet language is a slippery medium. And we often deceive and cause harm to ourselves or others without even realizing that this is what we're doing. Truthfulness, the positive counterpart of this precept, is therefore essential in the ethical life. But truthfulness is only one aspect of ethical speech. In another list of precepts, that is the 10 precepts followed by order members, no fewer than 4 speech precepts are mentioned, the others advising that our speech should be kindly, helpful, and harmonious. It requires a lot of awareness. So that's the 4th precept. And the 5th and final precept, in both its negative and positive form, is I undertake the training principle of abstaining from taking drinks and drugs that cloud the mind. And with mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. So the 5th precept is primarily the application of the principle of mindfulness. It's expressed in terms of abstention from drink and drugs that cloud the mind, however. So there's a certain amount of disagreement about this precept. So in some Buddhist countries, it's taken to mean you don't drink at all. And in other Buddhist countries, it's taken to mean that you can drink, but as long as you drink in moderation, not in excess. So you're free to take your choice between these two positions, really. So if you feel that you can drink without impairing your mindfulness, then by all means drink. But if you can't, then don't. But this position actually requires us to be absolutely honest with us. Because we might think, oh, you know, another one, that's fine. But in actual fact, we are losing our mindfulness. And that might lead to us sort of behaving unmindfully and unskillfully. Of course, there's more to this precept than the question of whether or not we drink alcohol or take drugs, even though that is quite important. Mindfulness is the characteristic virtue of the thinking or mental part of our makeup. It includes such practices as doing the washing up mindfully. So those of you who don't like washing up, there's quite a beauty to mindfully doing anything. Washing up, chopping vegetables, answering the phone with awareness, all of that, and so on. You know, there's a pleasure in mindfulness. There's also a pleasure, and I think, you know, thinking back to my very stressful job, the mind is happiest when it's doing one thing at a time, and when it's doing that one thing at a time mindfully. There's an enormous amount of joy in that. But mindfulness means, above all, that we continually bear in mind the true nature of our samsaric situation, of our situation in life, with all its suffering, and to continually bear in mind our goal towards enlightenment. So these precepts were taught and recommended by the Buddha. The Buddha says that one who is enlightened, one who has attained Buddhahood, one who has realized the plenitude of wisdom and the fullness of compassion, will inevitably behave in an ethical way. They can't but behave in that way. It comes naturally. Like Siddhishri said last week with Ratnasambhava, it's this continuous stream of ethical behavior, generosity, loving kindness, and so on. So what I wanted to do is take a story from the Pali Canon to see how the Buddha spontaneously demonstrates beautiful ethical behavior in terms of compassion, generosity, mindfulness, truthfulness, kindly, helpful speech. And I've chosen the story of the bhikkhu. Bhikkhu is a term for monks. The bhikkhu with dysentery. So here goes. Now, a certain bhikkhu was once sick with dysentery, and he lay fouled in his own urine and excrement. As the Blessed One was going the round of the lodgings with the Venerable Ananda as his attendant monk, he came to that bhikkhu's dwelling. When he saw him lying where he was, he went up to him and said, "What is your sickness, bhikkhu?" "It's dysentery, O Blessed One." "But bhikkhu, have you no attendant?" "No, Blessed One." "Why do they not look after you, bhikkhu?" "I'm no use to the bhikkhus, Lord. That's why they don't look after me." Then the Blessed One said to the Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, go and fetch some water. Let's wash this bhikkhu." "Even so, Lord," the Venerable Ananda replied, and he brought some water. The Blessed One poured out the water, and the Venerable Ananda washed the bhikkhu. Then the Blessed One took him by the head, and the Venerable Ananda took him by the feet, and they raised him up and put him on a bed. With this as the occasion and this as the reason, the Blessed One summoned the bhikkhus and asked them, "Bhikkhus, is there a bhikkhu sick in a certain dwelling?" "There is, Blessed One." "What is this bhikkhu's illness?" "He has dysentery, Lord." "Has he anyone to look after him?" "No, Blessed One." "Why do the bhikkhus not look after him?" "Lord, that bhikkhu is of no use to the bhikkhus. That is why they don't look after him." "Bhikkhus, you have neither mother nor father to look after you. If you do not look after each other, who will look after you? Let him who would look after me look after one who is sick. If he has a preceptor, his preceptor should, as long as he lives, look after him until his recovery. His teacher, if he has one, should do likewise. Or his co-resident, or his pupil, or one who has the same preceptor, or one who has the same teacher. If he has none of these, the community should look after him. Not to do so is an offense of wrongdoing." I mean, I love that reading, because the Buddha spontaneously shows his compassion, his generosity, his mindfulness. But also, had it been me, I would have gone and said, "Why is nobody looking after that bhikkhu?" You know, that bhikkhu. And he doesn't. He actually sort of says, he questions them to see what the response is. And he actually responds with very truthful, I mean, he's hammering home some truths there, but he does it with kindness and in harmony. I mean, nobody's going to get upset. I mean, they it will sort of sting them a bit, but he says it in such a way that it is actually kind, harmonious speech. So this is the perfection of ethics. Sila paramita. And the systematic practice of the precepts leads to an erosion of greed, hatred and delusion. And you probably know that greed, hatred and delusion are the three poisons that keep us going round and round and round samsara, round and round suffering. So practicing the five precepts erodes greed, hatred and delusion. And also it leads to an outpouring of loving kindness, of compassion, of generosity, of contentment, of truthful and kindly speech, and of mindfulness. That is the perfection of ethics. Beautiful principles that I have aspired to follow. Notice I say aspire. They have enhanced my life and helped me to grow. However, even though these ethical principles resonate somewhere deep within me and give me a sense of hope and freedom, I've learned to start where I am, from where I am. I think that's really, really important. There's no point in me pretending that I'm full of love when actually I'm feeling irritable or angry or whatever. I need to be aware of what's going on for me. I need to turn towards that anger, give it the attention it requires with love, kindness, with patience. And eventually, if I turn towards these unskillful mental states, eventually that particular negative mental state will resolve itself and self-liberate, giving way to more positive mental states and a sense of spaciousness and freedom. It's worth persevering there. We don't need to be perfect to follow the spiritual life. So I'm going to mention something that Jnanavacha mentioned in his talk, which he gave in January, to launch the Year of Positive Emotions. And there he quoted Ratnagosha, who said that during the years he was chair of the London Buddhist Centre, he noticed two major obstacles to spiritual progress. The first was people thinking that they had to be perfect to follow the spiritual life. And the second was people thinking that other people had to be perfect. It's really funny, actually. So that's not what's required. Actually, that's not what's required. What's required is the systematic observance of the precepts as best as we can. We're not perfect. It's an aspiration. This will enable us to see aspects of our conditioning at a very deep level and will provide us with a way of seeing through some of our unhelpful and unskillful mental states. So I'm going to give you an embarrassing example from my own experience. So the precepts for me have always been very, very important. And some years ago I decided that trying to hold all five precepts in one go was too much. So I decided to take one precept at a time and actually sort of really sort of reflect and meditate on that particular precept for a whole month. And I thought about it. What does it mean? I reflected. I measured how my actions sort of measured against it. That was a bit of a mistake. A tall order indeed, actually. Because the first thing I realised was how often, I shouldn't smile actually, because I realised how often I break the precepts. When I really look at it, I sort of break the precepts. But I don't give myself a hard time, and I didn't give myself a hard time about that then. Instead, I tried to get to the root of why I was breaking them. So this practice was very helpful, and it continually enabled me to go deeper and see my false views with more clarity. So to give you one example, there were loads, but to give you one example of how I went about this, 10 years ago I started a new job, and on paper the hours were 9 to 5. But in reality, actually, came 5 o'clock, nobody moved, and they just continued working until late in the evening. Does that ring a bell for some of you? I'm sure it does. So, yeah, nobody moved at 5 o'clock. The next day, my son was bringing his girlfriend home. He lived in Oxford, and he was bringing his girlfriend home, and it was the second time I had met her. So at 5 o'clock, I started packing all my books, and my mentor, who unfortunately used to sit next to me, said, "Oh, are you going home?" So, guilt. "Oh, yes," I said, "you know, my son's bringing his girlfriend home, and I want to be there to welcome them and feed them and so on." So she said, "And have you met her before?" And I said, "No." But that's even worse, actually, because it goes worse than this, because at that time, I was meditating, reflecting on the fourth precept, truthful communication. Can you imagine? For goodness sake. Yeah, so on the way home, feeling quite ashamed for having lied, I asked myself, why on earth did I lie? Why on earth did I do that? So reflecting on this, I realized that by saying that it was the first time I was meeting her, it sounded more important that I should actually leave on time. So going a bit deeper into this lie, it brought me back to that same old chestnut, which I find very painful, actually. By going home when others were staying, I was placing myself on the edge of acceptance and worthiness. I'd had a lifetime of feeling not worthy, not being wanted, not being acceptable, or feeling left out. And of course, you know, people saying to me, "You're leaving at 5, it's almost like I'm putting myself in that sort of situation of being left out, which I found extremely difficult. And what's very interesting is that 10 years ago, I was quite aware of all of this, and I was well on the way to intellectually sort of understanding and getting over that kind of, you know, I'm feeling left out and, you know, not wanted and nobody wants me and I don't fit in. But it's at a cellular level. At a cellular level, the same old conditioning was working its old magic. Magic's the wrong word for it, actually. These kind of experiences give us an insight at a very deep level about what is really going on for us. They start to loosen the grip of unhelpful conditioning and they give us a sense of freedom. These experiences are painful to acknowledge, but my spiritual aspirations keep me patiently going forward. You know, okay, I'm not perfect, I'm not keeping up with the precepts, but I still have the aspiration, and the aspiration is what keeps me going forward. So this is just one example where observance of the precepts actually has allowed me to see more deeply about what's really going on for me and given me sort of insights with a small eye. So that's the embarrassing bit. So let's move on and ask one very important question. What is the uniqueness of Buddhist ethics? All ethical systems, after all, whether they're religious or secular of society, have their own norm of ethics, and actions such as killing, theft, sexual misconduct, and falsehood are condemned universally. So superficially, one may think, actually, well, what's the difference between Buddhist ethics and the ethics of society, the ethics of other religions? When we look in detail at Buddhist ethics, we actually start to notice the difference. So, before comparing Buddhist ethics with the ethics of other systems, I want to go into what the essence of Buddhist ethics is about. So firstly, the essence of sila. Instead of speaking of actions being right or wrong, good or bad, in Buddhism we talk about actions being skillful or unskillful. Unskillful actions are those rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. And skillful actions are those which are free from greed, hatred, and delusion, and are motivated instead by the opposite tendencies of generosity, love, compassion, understanding. An important difference, a unique difference with Buddhist ethics, is that the precepts are not rules or commandments, but principles of training, which are undertaken freely. Nobody's forcing us to do this. And we need to practice them with awareness and sensitivity. The Buddhist tradition acknowledges that life is complex and throws up many difficulties. And it does not suggest that there is a single course of action that will be right in all circumstances. This requires us to consider the precepts not as a set of moral rules, a set of dead letters, but instead as training principles that enable us to act for the good, to avoid causing harm, and to take our Buddhist practice more and more deeply. In the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, there's a section entitled The Ten Precepts as Rules of Training, where Sangharakshita mentions ways in which we can train in the precepts. He suggests that one way of training in the precepts is to genuinely imbibe the spirit of the precepts as distinct from the letter of the precepts. So how do we imbibe the spirit of the precepts? So we can do this in various ways. One way, one very good way, is to study the life of the Buddha. So often in the Pali Canon, the Buddha's walking along, he encounters somebody, he has this interaction with that person, and then you see and you hear his ethical sensibility. It's just beautiful, it's absolutely beautiful. So that's, you know, an excellent way to imbibe the spirit of the precepts. Other ways of imbibing the spirits of the precepts is through studying the Dharma and then reflecting on the Dharma and meditating on the Dharma to make it your own. And yet another way is through spiritual friendship, what we refer to as Kalyana Mitrata, associating ourselves as much as possible with others who are practicing the precepts, others who are really having a go at observing the precepts and living out the precepts in their lives. So often you'll find that some people are truly ethical in some respects. I mean, in other respects, you might be more ethical than them. But it's beautiful, actually, to see people behaving beautifully. It is beautiful behavior. So continuing with the essence of sila, the goal of ethical conduct in Buddhism is self-control, self-understanding, and self-development. Every individual is responsible for his or her own spiritual destiny. And that ultimately requires us to have confidence in ourselves. Now, confidence is supremely important in our spiritual lives. We have our own answers. We do have our own answers. But we also have the precepts to guide us. And until we get in touch with our own answers, the precepts are there as a blueprint. It's almost like an apprenticeship. You know, you sit next to somebody, a plumber, for example, and you eventually learn the trade. You sit next to, metaphorically speaking, the Buddha and his behavior and so on, and eventually you will learn that trade. It's not trade, but you know what I mean. Buddhism is also, continuing with the essence of sila, Buddhism is non-theistic. That is, it doesn't teach belief in a personal God, a supreme being, nor does it hold that religion consists in submission to or faith in such a supreme being. There is no divine retribution. There is no fire and brimstone. Thank goodness. Instead, there is cause and effect and the law of karma. There's no time here to go into the complexities of the laws of karma, but we will be doing that next week. Next week, we've got a text about karma, and we'll have an opportunity to explore that more fully. But no time to go into the complexities here. But simply put, skillful and unskillful actions bring their own reward or retribution. The opening words of the Dhammapada illustrate this point. The Buddha says, what we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. If a woman speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows her, as the wheel of the cart follows the beast that draws the cart. What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. If a woman speaks or acts with a pure mind, joy follows her as her own shadow. So the ethical code in Buddhism is not externally imposed but internally motivated. It is an essential prerequisite for the training of the mind, which leads to the elimination of ignorance and to enlightenment. The Buddha's teaching on the threefold path makes us see that ethics is the first stage of the path, a very important part, but it's the first stage. The second being meditation and the third being wisdom. Virtuous behavior, you might be surprised to hear this, but virtuous behavior alone does not enable us to break through to enlightenment. But the systematic practice of ethics will take us on to the further stages of the path. Ethical conduct is a means to the realization of a greater end, and that is wisdom. Wisdom is the threshold as well as the culmination of Buddhist practice. Ethics and meditation are the chief means to the realization of this great goal. So I've explored some of the essence of sila. And what I want to do with the third part of my talk is to spell out the uniqueness of Buddhist ethics in comparison to the ethics of other systems. And I think what I'm going to say is implicit on what I've said in terms of the essence of sila, but I still think it's worth drawing out some points. In doing this, I'm going to restrict myself to three criteria. So the first thing I'm going to do is look at the rules themselves, briefly. Secondly, is the motivation for following the rules. And thirdly, the policing of the rules. So firstly, the ethical rules themselves. In Buddhism, the precepts are unqualified. That's the first point I want to make. They're unqualified. For example, the first precept regarding not taking life. Well, many ethical systems prescribe the not taking of life, but this is usually restricted to human beings and the killing of humans. Buddhism applies the rule to all sentient beings, and that includes animals. That's why we give such importance to vegetarianism in the Triratna Buddhist community. And furthermore, even in the case of humans, in some ethical systems there are exceptions. And sometimes the exceptions are allowed, for example, for holy wars or just wars. Buddhism admits no such exemptions. You know, we can only think of, you know, all the wars. I mean, what's happened... I was affected quite strongly, actually, with the bombing on the underground, that terrorist attack on the underground. And that, I mean, I wasn't hurt myself, but people that I know were hurt. And you think, how can that be justified? How can that be justified? And it sort of horrifies me to think that they're now talking about... Is it no-fly zone over Libya? You know, you might get involved in another, you know, sort of, yeah. There's no exception in Buddhism to killing. So that's the first criterion. The second is the motivation for following the rules. As I've already said, the motivation for following the precepts in Buddhism is self-control, self-understanding and self-development as an essential prerequisite for the elimination and ignorance of the attainment of enlightenment. It's therefore an internal motivation with the responsibility squarely on the individual. In theistic religions, the motivation for allowing their ethical precepts, for following their ethical precepts, is as a means to the union with God, whether in an abstract metaphysical sense or more directly as entry into the kingdom ruled by God. In such a system, the most important rule or commandment is not usually an ethical one, but belief in, love of, submission and obedience to God. The ethical rules come subsequently. Therefore, the motivation in theistic religions is mainly external, relying largely on divine grace. And when we look at the ethics of society, such as those embodied in legal systems, the motivation is usually the avoidance of social conflict. Buddhism ethics too leads to social harmony, but this harmony is achieved through individual efforts towards perfection, rather than through the compulsory observance of legalistic rules. So here again, the motivation is largely external. The third criterion, lastly, is the policing of the rules, the way good and bad conduct results in appropriate consequences. In policing the rules, two approaches may be distinguished. The first approach relies on trial and punishment, or reward, for the individual. And it is the theistic and secular approach. The supreme judicial authority is God to the theist, or simply the normal judicial processes in the case of society. The second approach, which is the Buddhist approach, relies on the workings of an impersonal law, the law of karma, the laws of cause and effect. Actions have got consequences, and we bring upon ourselves, to a large extent, retribution or reward. The law of karma makes divine authority redundant. So the legal mode of trial and punishment is actually quite suited to society, because it's a way of actually, you know, preservation of authority of the state, as well as the well-being of society. So I suppose in that sense, it's okay. But when this model is used, for personal moral conduct and behaviour as in divine judgment, we come across the doctrine of the forgiveness of sins, which negates the principle that actions have got consequences and relies not on the scrupulous observance of the ethical rules of the system, but the element of blind faith in its dogmas. Well, I was brought up as a Catholic, and the main message I received as I grew up was that no matter what I did, as long as I confessed it on a Sunday, then everything was okay. I'm sure it's not as simple as this as in Catholicism, but actually, that was the message I was receiving, and that was going on in my mind, actually. As long as I confess it, I can do whatever I like, you know, and then say 10 Hail Marys, and I'm okay. I just want to say that the five precepts are precious. This is the end of my talk. They are training principles that help us in our struggle to move away from unskillful mental states and towards freedom. They inspire and encourage the qualities of kindness, gentleness and self-control, of simplicity, contentment and serenity commended by the Buddha himself. These qualities lead in time to the enjoyment of that vision of the truth that can satisfy the deepest longings of the human heart. I wanted to end back with the perfection of ethics by reading the Metta Sutta, which are the Buddha's words on loving kindness. I'm aware of time, actually, but I'm going to go for it anyway, because it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And the Metta Sutta emphasizes the importance of the love mode, not the power mode, as the supreme principle by which the Sangha should be governed. So here goes. This is what should be done by those who are skilled in goodness and who know the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.